You're listening to a program produced in 2017 by Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place at the historic Central Library in downtown Los Angeles. Aloud is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more, please visit lfla.org/aloud. Tonight, the Aloud stage is graced with two brilliant guests, Ayanna Thompson and Peter Sellers, who will discuss the ways in which Shakespeare's plays provide rich texts through which some of the most pressing problems in our world, including the challenges facing systems of justice, can be debated, and even how solutions to those problems might even be imaginable. That would be nice. How does race inform our understanding of Shakespeare? And as well, how does Shakespeare impact our understanding of race? How does Shakespeare both ignite our idealism, as Peter Sellers has noted, quote, while remaining still the great poet of compromise, disappointment, and failed hopes? Ayanna Thompson is professor of English at George Washington University. She specializes in Renaissance drama and issues of race in as performance. And in her recent book, Passing Strange, Shakespeare, Race, and Contemporary America, she draws on an unconventional array of contemporary texts, including films, novels, theatrical productions, YouTube videos, and performances, to boldly examine questions such as whether Shakespeare's plays need to be edited, appropriated, updated, or rewritten to affirm racial equality and retain relevance. Her skillful and passionate examination of Shakespeare is considered an important step forward in Shakespeare scholarship. A great scholar just wrote that her work was quite prescient, even a model for artistic and social redemption. And Peter Sellers, who I'm sure many of you in the room have heard before and are eager to hear tonight, is one of the most powerful and creatively disruptive forces in the performing arts in America and abroad today. He's known for his groundbreaking interpretations of classic works. He staged numerous Shakespeare plays, including The Merchant of Venice and Othello with John Ortiz and Philip Seymour Hoffman, and Midsummer Night's Dream, which, according to critics, quote, made a familiar play newly strange and strangely new. He collaborated with Nobel laureate Toni Morrison and Malian composer singer Rokia Traore on a 21st century concert play called Desdemona, which introduces us to Desdemona's African maid, Barbary. He asked Toni Morrison, he commented, quote, to challenge Shakespeare's blind spots, his missing links and missing information. There's no way to call out all of Peter's amazing, even life-changing productions, and those who attend UCLA's World Arts and Culture are so fortunate, as Peter is a professor there. And we are also fortunate because, listening to what Peter's schedule is, it's remarkable that he and Ayanna are here in the same room on this very night, this particular night, this particular moment. So please join me in welcoming both of our very distinguished guests. Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you so much. Great to see everyone tonight. And this is definitely not a night to be home alone. Find some friends and stay with them.
On such a night as this. So, Peter, can I start by asking, I call it the Shakespeare origins question. What was the first Shakespeare you saw live? And do you think there's a connection with where you went with Shakespeare in your personal and professional life?
So just so everybody understands, we're really here to meet Ayanna. And this is the revelation of the evening. Her latest book, which is about teaching Shakespeare, is so inspiring. I mean, the series of books before that, prescient is a word. In fact, you know, everything we're dealing with in the last 20 years, Ayanna has been on the case, enabling us to realize that Shakespeare was on the case. And Shakespeare is right here, right now, dealing with what needs to be dealt with. And Ayanna has been just one of those amazing people to just say, look more closely, listen more closely. And as soon as a wider range of people are looking into Shakespeare's mirror of art, we see a wider range of humanity in each other and in ourselves, and realize that Shakespeare was writing about everything we're trying to deal with.
But you were there first, Peter.
So just all I want to just say
I'll pay you later, but
my first Shakespeare isn't that helpful. I staged The Tempest when I was a junior in high school. And so you asked me what my first Shakespeare was. I try not to remember it.
Is that the first you saw? But did you see any live Shakespeare before you staged The Tempest?
I must have, but I can't think of it. Huh. I really just can't. The first time I really think of Shakespeare is deciding in high school that I had to do a Shakespeare play. And I did The Tempest with puppets and shadow puppets. And all of the text had been pre-recorded and a kind of wild installation. And it was very, very, very boring. And I just, everything I didn't know about Shakespeare, I find out right after that. But and The Tempest is an incredible play, not bad to start with the end, but I mean, weird and stupid to start with the end. Anyway, very annoying. Was my first Shakespeare, and I cringe when I really think about it and everything I didn't get. On the other hand, my second Shakespeare is more interesting.
Okay.
Coriolanus is like, how difficult are things? Very difficult. And what do you do when in Rome? And the kind of just fury and rage of Roman politics. And this politics of sheer rage, politics of resentment, politics just fueled by contempt and by self-contempt, embarrassment, needing to prove things just because you're freaked out. And this overwhelming sense that the only way you can approach life is negatively. And that play was the second play I did as a freshman in college, and was I think one of the first moments that in that play you can't miss the fact that the character who Shakespeare admires is silent. Everyone else is bloviating and carrying on and screaming and ranting for pages, and only Virgilia has, you know, I think the long speech has 5 words in it, and it's quiet, thoughtful, feeling, listening, and radiant, and the place of redemption, not only for herself, but a hope for a whole society, which Shakespeare shows, you know, ancient Rome having truly in a suicide struggle. And you watch Rome really destroy itself from within, and the only solution is to let the barbarians in, because there's some hope there. And so it's a very, that play was, yeah, that's a strong one to go into college with.
That's amazing.
That's amazing. So that was, yeah, that's a... Okay, over to you for Shakespeare, go.
So since I am... Oh, I think... Do I have the dead mic? No? Okay, good. There was anxiety that there was a dead mic, so... Since I don't stage anything and I just watch it. I grew up very poor. Somehow my mother scraped together money for us to take a little short European vacation when I was 13 and ended up in Stratford-upon-Avon. Why? And saw Romeo and Juliet at the Royal Shakespeare Company oh my God, I'm blanking on his name. It'll come to me. But it was this amazingly kind of updated production where everyone was in sort of like 1980s leather outfits. And Tybalt was played by a black actor. And it was, I had never seen any Shakespeare. I hadn't really read that much. I think I read Macbeth when I was 8 in my closet because I liked witches and stuff. But so this is first, you know, encounter with Shakespeare was that it was about now, very now, right? It was about sex. It was about leather. It was about you know, a multicultural world. It wasn't until later that I realized that that was an unusual production and that most people were seeing things in pumpkin pants. And when I saw that, I was like, what? Of course you're not going to like that. I just thought... So, and of course, I go on to write a lot about non-traditional casting and multicultural Shakespeare, and it's all written into that first production that I saw when I was 13. So, isn't that amazing?
That is pretty awesome. That is,
and Hugh Quarshie, by the way, was the Tybalt. So,
oh wow,
yeah,
you know, and I didn't grow up seeing anything like that, of course, and for me, that was one of the big issues in theater was not seeing a bunch of people in the audience who clearly were living in America, but not in American theaters. And why they weren't in the audience is because they also were not on the stage. And so for me, that was growing up, there was like, something's wrong with this picture. What is wrong with this picture? It's not, the mirror is not pointed towards anything interesting enough. And let's just make sure that this mirror is actually reflecting back to us who the we is in this country.
But that's what amazes me about your early Harvard productions, because you were out getting Brother Blue. And, you know, like, you probably all know Peter's career, but when he was at Harvard, he's casting, like, black street performers in King Lear. And, like, you know, things that other, you know, your classmates weren't doing, right? So how was it that you were able to think of the mirror as being so much more expansive?
Just walking down the street. You just say, like, how come? And I think, again, you just have to, the cool thing is Shakespeare is writing for an audience that's standing up. You know, it's really street people. It's people who are, it's not about a zone of privilege. It's a zone of immediate street energy that you're feeling in these plays. And again, the most, over and over again, the most exciting scenes in Shakespeare are these weird walk-ons who show up for like one tiny little scene, and they say, have two lines. And again, one of the big deals for me was realizing how much Shakespeare respected people who had two lines. Mm-hmm. You know, we tend to think, oh, right, the important person is the person who's still talking and hogging the microphone forever. And for Shakespeare, it's like whenever they're done, someone who really knows what they're talking about will say two words. Because that's all they need to say, because they know what they're talking about. And those little scenes of street people that occur all the time in Shakespeare, working class people who know the deal. Their boss is still ranting, but the employee knows perfectly well what's real and what isn't, and only needs a sentence to say it. And that part of Shakespeare was so powerful to me. And, of course, even from The Tempest, you know, the idea that Shakespeare's universe is peopled by all kinds of beings. You know, it's not one class of humanity or indeed fauna. You know, this Shakespeare is in mind anything that's alive, which means, yes, the stones weep, which means the stones are speaking in Shakespeare. And again, this kind of incredible sense that there was nothing that was not communicating for him. And he created the conditions where every class of society was represented in every play. There's not a play that doesn't cut across the class system. And that is so powerful that his vision just refused to say, we're going to now set this play among one class of people. Every single play insists on all classes of people are present, represented, and participants. And that social dynamism is so thrilling. And then, of course, it's matched by a metaphysical sense of cosmology, of every human being a divine representative and a moral bellwether. And the chance for the salvation or damnation, not of themselves, but of the universe. And that was just so thrilling, that the fate of the universe hangs on a walk-on part. You know, which is very beautiful. You know, that he has, and this great sense that you can change tone but still be serious, that something can turn into a ridiculous joke out of nowhere, and then, but it doesn't mean you're not serious. Like Cleopatra is killing herself, and Shakespeare has a clown bring on the snake. Excuse me, what? This is the time for a big joke? A little comedy number? What are you talking about? And Shakespeare got the point that just when you're trying to be really serious, life is handing you a joke. And you're never allowed to just be serious about yourself because life won't let that happen. Life will also hold up the absurdity of everything you're doing in the same moment that you're so convinced of how serious you are. That is so intense.
There's a great moment in Titus Andronicus, a play I want you to do in the future. and we might want to think a little bit about black vengeance. But anyway, but there is a moment that is always cut in every production I've seen. It's been cut where a messenger comes in and wants to deliver pigeons to Saturninus, the emperor of Rome. And Titus slips some weapons into his delivery of pigeons. And he goes to, so this innocent guy goes to deliver the pigeons, and Saturninus sees the weapons and says, all right, you're off to get executed. It's like, you know, 10 lines maybe. But you see how vulnerable this messenger is. It's funny and heartbreaking all at once, and the kind of capriciousness of the power. I don't know. I think you'd make a lot of that scene.
Oh, my God.
I bugged him about Titus in the past, and he's like,
You know, when I was growing up, no one was doing it. I mean, there was the famous production by Peter Brook that was pretty cool, from what I read. But now everybody is doing it. So I just have to say, okay, I just want to, for me, I always try and give things a rest when I think they're really well represented. And then when you think, wait a minute, again, what is missing from this picture? Then it's time to do it, you know? And so on the other hand, there are also very, 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 very well-known famous things that I think, how come nobody's getting this? And then it's time to do a famous thing also. Titus is tough. No, it's so unforgiving. And I think that's probably, for me, I did start at the other end of Shakespeare. Okay, so there are a couple of things probably just to mention that Ayana's referring to a little bit, because we know each other. One of the things that I always do when I'm directing a Shakespeare play is I go through and make cuts of everything that I can't understand, that's just too dense and obscure, where the language is just ridiculously obscure, and it kind of hijacks the scene, or, you know, it becomes this obstacle, and you have to go all the way around it to get where the scene is going. So I say, okay, we have to cut that, or something where it's repeated, and, you know, we've heard that, we don't need to hear that again, or, you know, those just really annoying things in Shakespeare, and I just go through and I mark all those things that you really don't need, and then I base my entire production on the things that I tried to cut.
So he doesn't cut them at all. He emphasizes them. Because, you know, those maddening scenes, the awful jokes between Iago and Desdemona.
I put them all there. Well, you know, again, I think for me, the thing is always something that I think was not necessary, and Shakespeare said, "No, no, we need this." Shakespeare said, "No, no, I can write a perfectly clear English sentence, and I'm not going to do that here. I'm really going to go into this nightmare thicket with brambles and a just total, you will not come out unbloodied from trying to figure out what the sentence is. And people have worked on this sentence for 400 years. And, you know, the audience is going to have maybe 40 seconds. But that's how poetry works. It's not about understanding it. It's about something deeper. Because how much of your life do you understand? Almost none of it, in fact. So get over the understanding part. and try to live inside the contradiction and everything that you don't understand, you have to keep living. And that life force in the plays that takes you through those things and takes you through the repetitions and says you don't get to go straight to here because life will never let you go straight to there. Life is going to take you on some detour that you did not plan to go on. And that's the power of Shakespeare. And any other author would just say, okay, I know where I'm going. We're going to go there. And Shakespeare says, I know where I'm going, and therefore I have to go everywhere else. That is so thrilling. And the insistence on complexity, when all of us just say, now wait a minute, we can just simplify this, which is for me one of the drags of seeing Shakespeare so often, because these days Shakespeare is just absolutely reduced to a sixth grade, you know, take-home multiple-choice test. It's so embarrassing. These plays are so rich, and what people are staging is the plot synopsis, not the actual play. And the play takes you so much deeper, and you truly get lost in it. And for me, that I'd rather be lost than found in Shakespeare. I really, to me, that anybody who writes a play that's that hard to summarize, or even people who know these plays can't describe the plot, because Shakespeare didn't write the play for the plot. He has everything else in mind, because what your story is the smallest part of who you are. That story you tell yourself is not mostly true. There are a whole bunch of episodes you left out, a whole bunch of weird little people in your life who totally changed the picture that you prefer not to remember. There's just a whole lot more going on. So for me, that richness is so vital in Shakespeare. And I think for me, the reason I just became overwhelmed and devoted to Iana's books are that I grew up in the old tradition where an elderly British gentleman told you what Shakespeare meant. And that was the definitive. And I met those guys who were the definitive word on what Shakespeare meant. And a little suffocating. And you know, what it meant to them. But not those guys didn't notice that I was not them. I knew what it meant to them. That's nice. But it truly had nothing to do with what it meant to me. And Iana has pioneered a series of books writing about Shakespeare, which give a whole range of people permission to find what they find in Shakespeare. Because any great work of art is not about what it means to some critic. It's about what it means to you in your life, where you are right now. All the things you're feeling, all the things that are on your mind, all the things you can't articulate. Shakespeare is giving that a voice, is giving that some amazing new form that you couldn't have imagined. But it's actually as a way to invite you to imagine. And what's so thrilling, Iana, for me about, well, her book, Wayward Macbeth, please get that book. Wayward, W-E-Y-W-A-R-D. Would you just say what the word wayward means?
Well, it's it's slightly
Miss Witches, Miss Little Interest in Witches.
So the witches in Macbeth are in one version of the play called Wayward Sisters and another called Weird Sisters. So it's but the idea that they are not quite right or maybe faded. There's lots of different meanings to the term. But Wayward Macbeth is a book about how often Macbeth has been appropriated by Americans of color, and how often we forget that narrative. And so there's this weird historical amnesia about the fact that actually this is kind of a black play, and it has been for centuries. So that's what the book is about, really.
Say two more sentences about it, because that's, I mean, yes, and...
It's two more sentences.
Yes, at least.
Well, that it can be both an empowering appropriation and a stifling one, right? So if you know any actresses of color who are classically trained, I bet that they've played a witch because. The witch parts have become part of the unofficial black canon. There are these roles that now are almost always cast for actors of color, and the witches are definitely part of that. And so many actresses of color have talked about, like, yay, I'm classically trained, I'm going out for my first part, and I'm a witch. And they don't get to play the other parts that they thought that they would play or the parts that they played in drama school. But it can also be an empowering appropriation when you get a community together that is thinking about power, that is thinking about succession of power, is taking a classical text and using it as a way of seizing power in their community. This can be incredibly empowering. So really the book and a lot of my work is about how it's both and. It's both this...
Like pretty Shakespearean.
Very Shakespearean. And I wanted to return to something that you said about complexity. And because I think Shakespeare is the most complex writer that we have, right? Playwright that we have. And part of our struggle now is that we have lost the collective narrative about the pleasure of grappling with complexity. And I think your productions are such a revelation. Every time I see one, it's because you are like, we're taking it on together, people. And even when some audience members can't, because they want their sixth grade Cliff Notes version of Shakespeare in pumpkin pants, and you're not giving them that, and so they're going to leave at the intermission. And you're always there in the audience saying, move up. Come on, let's do this together. You know, like the fact that you want the collective to grapple together is something that we don't have enough of. So I wondered if you could talk about, you know, embracing complexity and how you work through complexity with your actors.
Well, I think, again, we're just every single day in front of such ideals that we have, watching them be shattered. Which, you know, is a deepening process for a human being. It's just to stand and watch something you truly love be destroyed. Or something you were hoping could go another way actually be reversed and go horribly wrong. And, you know, we tend to be a little solipsistic in thinking we're the first people who ever saw that. And you want to say, excuse me. That is human history. And you think it's bad here, I can take you a few other places. Yeah. Let's go to the Congo this week. Right? Anything we're dealing with looks like, you know, some, you know, nice British play of the 50s.
How about Aleppo?
You know, there's just, take your pick right now. The degree of calamity and the degree of we've gone so deep and so long in the wrong direction. How do you turn around and retrace your steps back to road we wanted to be on? Anywhere in the world right now. So in fact, we're in front of something so complex, so intricate, that has so many weird little aspects to it, that if we need to develop a taste one more time, which Shakespeare's audience had, to go into something deeply for all the weird, strange little plots and subplots, for all the odd little characters you say, what, who's that, what now? All of that just kind of strangeness. And also the nightmare of Shakespeare of, you know, if you're Brutus, you really think you're the only person with a conscience in the world. And then in the second half of the play, you become the problem. What? And Shakespeare really goes there. Shakespeare goes to the fact that life doesn't hand you what you asked for in your mind, but what you asked for in your actions. And then makes each of us have to re-examine our actions in a way that's really a shock. And probably, if I think of it that way, I would have to say my earliest Shakespeare experience is my Uncle Floyd. Did we talk about my Uncle Floyd?
No, and now
have
I want to...
Have we talked about my Uncle Floyd?
No, I've not heard about Uncle Floyd.
Oh, my God. Well, you know, my on my mother's side of the family, grew up in rural Ohio. And Uncle Floyd was, educated in a one-room schoolhouse, and the main text was Shakespeare. Year in, year out, that was the book. And my Uncle Floyd became a postman in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And my Uncle Floyd was fairly forgetful and would frequently, you know, get on the bus to go make his postal rounds and just sleep and arrive in some stop way on the other side of the city. But what Uncle Floyd could do on any occasion is quote Shakespeare. And there was not one moment where Shakespeare was not at Uncle Floyd's right hand. And no matter what was going on, Uncle Floyd...
It's always appropriate.
...had a line from Shakespeare that just nailed it. And so probably that was my earliest Shakespeare was Uncle Floyd the postman.
See, but that also taught you that Shakespeare's always relevant, right?
It's relevant and is also, again, and here I have to, you know, quote or misquote Maya Angelou, but just in my own life and in my own family, Shakespeare is an American playwright. And I hate to break it to these irritating British people, but, you know, Shakespeare was writing about America. You know, not like Tony Blair's England, for God's sake. You know, I mean, England stopped being what Shakespeare's writing about a long time ago. Shakespeare's writing about the most powerful nation in the world, you know, that controlled the oceans and the air and was making the economic decisions for the whole planet. And Shakespeare's writing about that country that was actually setting literally the agenda for the planet, which is one reason he called his theater the Globe, because it's about a world power. And right in the heart of London, we're going to call our theater the Globe because that is actually the stage of our country, is the Globe. And so that's why America is the topic and subject of Shakespeare's plays. And Shakespeare's really writing about us.
So thinking about justice moving forward, and racial justice and economic justice, what Shakespeare will you turn to? I mean, it doesn't have to be a Shakespeare that you're going to necessarily direct, but if you're thinking through these issues with Shakespeare, what is it that you're going to look at or think through?
Well, you know, sitting here in Los Angeles at the moment tonight, where I live, I have to say probably the Shakespeare play that is so on my mind, that I sat in Los Angeles, was only seen in America in Chicago. I did a production of The Merchant of Venice just after the LA uprising in 1992. And I did it at the Goodman Theater in Chicago. Things were a little hot in LA. And I cast Shylock, and his friends were African Americans. Portia and her friends were wealthy Asians living in Bel Air. And all the Venetians were Latino. And of course, the judge is white, because that's always the case. And we just did an economic, you know, Shakespeare dealt with the economics of racism and dealt with the forms that it took, what the economic consequences of racism are, and the meaning of the word ghetto has not changed in 9 centuries. A ghetto is invented as a absolutely unattractive real estate that you force one group to live in, surround with police, and charge them twice as much for really subprime goods as everyone else is paying. And you keep them there in this segregated nightmare. And then blame them for their own subjugation. And none of that changed. Shakespeare absolutely goes in The Merchant of Venice through that systemically and deals with it, of course, in the sense of Venice as one of the first multicultural centers of Europe where the world is truly meeting. So the range of characters, you know, are the Prince of Aragon and the Prince of Morocco. So you're getting the Mediterranean, you're getting this incredible sense of, again, a global view. But you're also getting the gold and silver from the mines here in Mexico and in South America. And the New World is very much part of, and the New World as slavery and the New World as absolute exploitation and rape of natural resources, but also destruction of the human beings who are carrying your gold to you. And Shakespeare puts all of that, you know, unbelievably directly, and then the fourth act of The Merchant of Venice, which is just so shattering and shocking, where, you know, the positive figure in the play, Portia, delivers this gorgeous, gorgeous speech about justice, mercy, the quality of mercy, and then proceeds to frame this guy in court and take everything he owns from him. The very person who understood mercy. And then Shylock is ruined, and everyone can go home. And they've got all the money, and they're feeling really good about themselves. What? And then Shakespeare gives you this shocking Act 5, where all the lovers finally get together, and they've totally forgotten how to be in love. Because the absence of justice means that they won. They framed this guy. They won the court case. But when they go home, something's missing in their lives, which is justice, which is truth, which is love, which is mercy. And you look at each other and say, what kind of people are we? We're winners. We're winners. We won again. And every single day we've lost. Now that play is a pretty powerful play about racism, about the economics, not just of the money, but the economics of what it means when you forget how to love. And what happens when your capacity to love is seriously compromised by your ability to turn a blind eye to questions of justice and equality. And you don't mind profiting from someone else's tragedy, misfortune, or in fact, hurt. And that injustice seems fine because you're on the side of it that's winning and you're comfortable. So that play probably, Shakespeare just goes out of his way to make the climax of a play in a courtroom and show you one more rigged verdict and one more time where the person of color, of course, is not judged by their peers And of course, one more time, where the person of color is blamed for everything and then has everything taken from them all over again. That play's not going out of date. And again, the weird thing about Shakespeare is so many, you can read everywhere that that play is anti-Semitic. And of course, that's the reason you have to read Shakespeare closely. It's not anti-Semitic at all. But it's also about how fine the line is. How very fine the line is between what we imagine and what we're actually doing. Where we are morally in our self-image, and in fact, what are the actions that we're perpetuating or participating in that we don't want to acknowledge are benefiting us in some way, and that in fact are destroying us. And the play, Shakespeare goes out of his way not to be anti-Semitic, but also goes out of his way to make that absolutely straight and narrow path impossible. And scene after scene, the play, you have to ask yourself, you can't just say, oh, I'm seeing racism over here and not racism over here. Every single moment, you have to say, wait a minute, which side am I on? Where do I stand? Hold it. In relation to this, hold it. Did this just turn? What? And you have to rethink your own position moment by moment in that entire play. And he will never let you be comfortable with the fact you're not racist or that you are racist. Every single scene, you have to interrogate yourself about where you are with this. And you watch the characters just do the most shocking things while claiming the opposite. You know, famously in that play are those, you know, astonishing speech about music, the most beautiful speech ever written about music by someone who hates music. And Shakespeare goes out of his way to say, if you can talk about it well, it probably means you don't understand it. Because again, the people who understand it didn't say anything. And that play is so filled with people who talk beautifully and do the opposite. People who don't even know their own thoughts, but are just so intent on presenting themselves to other people that they haven't begun to notice who they actually are. So that play and Othello have been, of course, pretty much on my mind these last two decades. Yeah. Othello is how we met, because this woman was doing the breakthrough writing about, first of all, a book, Colorblind Shakespeare. Colorblind Shakespeare, would you just say a word about that awesome book? That book, you know, because there was a period in casting where everyone said, okay, let's put more black people in this. But again, the witches or whatever. But also, this idea that casting was colorblind, that you could just look at somebody and listen to them, but ignore who they actually were and what life histories they were bringing on stage with them. And not notice that certain people are empowered to speak about certain things exactly because of the struggles they've been through. And those struggles actually illuminate the play, or the play illuminates those struggles. And of course, well, say a word about Colorblind Shakespeare, because it's so brilliant strategically.
So it's an old book now.
A classic, I think, is how I would describe
it. Okay. I had been trying to find some materials about casting practices for film and was like, well, someone must have written a book about casting practices with regards to race for Shakespeare. And I was mentioning this to a colleague at a conference when we were shopping for books at the book display. And the editor of this press of Routledge happened to be standing at the book display. And I said, I can't believe there's no book on colorblind casting or non-traditional casting and Shakespeare, because it's so widespread and it's kind of all over the place in terms of practice. And I haven't found anyone who's sort of theorized this yet. and the editor said, you have to do this book. I had just finished graduate school and was like, I don't know anything. And he goes, no, you have to do this book. He found me. He hunted me down 6 months later, and he's like, I'm serious that you have to do this book. So I did, and it was really the first collection to think through not only the different sets of practices that are used by theater companies, but also the kind of theoretical underpinnings or lack thereof for those practices, which was the big revelation, is that basically no one had thought it through, and that there was this sort of sense that if we just put it on stage, people will make sense of it, and that's enough. So a lot of my work has been about thinking through the ethics of racial casting, thinking through the scaffolding that needs to go on with your community to have dialogues about what they're seeing on stage and how they're making sense of that or what doesn't make sense to them. So that was Colorblind Shakespeare.
And super complex because, again, you know, human beings are just carrying incredible histories.
Right. And, you know, what's fascinating, and to this touches back to something you said earlier about British Shakespeare's. In England, they really only cast, they only use colorblind Shakespeare, I mean, colorblind casting. They don't want you to notice the race of the person on stage. And when I've pressed the actors and directors and theater personnel about this, they really have no language to talk about what's going on stage or the fact that their audiences experience something completely different than what they think they're doing. And so I think, again, this is a moment where I'm like, well, at least in the States, we have had more dialogues about this and that there's a wider range of possibilities, that we're not just locked into one model and hoping to God that that works out. And I will also say that there's been some really interesting data collected recently in the UK and in the US, because a lot of people have the assumption that UK classical theater is more diverse than it is in the US. And in fact, that's not the case. The numbers have been holding steady for two decades for both in the US and in the UK. There's not been any progress. And also the types of parts, the unofficial black canon that I mentioned before, is very strong in the UK. So, should we open it up to other people? Or
we should. I just want to say one more thing.
Yeah.
Yes, I would love to get into Shakespeare placing every play on a national precipice, since that's where we are. And really just Shakespeare's understanding of, first of all, how fragile every act of good is and how amazingly enduring acts of evil turn out to be. But again, the fact that the acts of evil have their own self-destruction built in and are literally unsustainable. And Shakespeare's ability to take you from the most bitter part of that, and I think King Lear is a big play that I've spent a lot of my life with. It's the most unbearable play ever written. From the bleakest, most furious, I mean, Shakespeare's so furious with the world, is so furious with the betrayal of everything we believe in, and we betray ourselves and our beliefs every moment, and he's so furious. And the play is a play written by a really angry man who leaves nothing standing. That's right. And then says, wait a minute, I have to get a grip. And tries to come back and be a little less bitter and comes up with Timon of Athens, which is just truly horrible. And then says, you know what? I am the problem. And then has these last four plays, which he tries to stop being so angry. And Pericles and Cymbeline and The Winter's Tale and The Tempest. He's trying to write a play that has a happy ending that's not cheating, that's not a fairy tale. It has to be a happy ending that we get to together across every kind of adversity that we're really facing. And the happy ending isn't cheap. The happy ending is earned. and the happy ending isn't just because of one person, but the happy ending is because a community rescues themselves.
Yeah, I think that's the important part in those romances, right? That while many of them are around nuclear families being reunited and stitched back together, that it's actually always about the larger community in those plays as well. That there's like this social knitting that happens outside of the nuclear family that's reunited. And that's exactly what we need now.
And I think for me, the Pericles, which is something, you know, I did early on. Well, you know, of course, duh. But for me, one of the most powerful things about Pericles is it's really Shakespeare trying to go through the entire history of the world. People have said, oh, right, the language shows that maybe lots of different people wrote it. It's a kind of collage. But it's quite the opposite. It's Shakespeare deliberately writing the opening act in a prehearsed history, Conan the Barbarian language, then gradually moving up into a Greek civilization, gradually moving up into a Roman civilization, gradually moving up into a medieval civilization in the Amor Courtois in the third act, and then gradually moving into his own time period, the Ben Jonson City Comedy of the fourth act. And then in act five, as T.S. Eliot famously said, it is the language of people who have not yet been born. And Shakespeare deliberately in one play trying to take you through the entire struggle of humanity. Every act, the title character is shipwrecked and thrown up on the shore of a new place and tries to start civilization again and encounters each new phase of human civilization. That's pretty ambitious for somebody who really feels we have to start over and look back on where we've been and really ask ourselves where we need to go. Really, where do we need to go? And let's put that forward and hold that in front of ourselves right now. Because the Ben Jonson City Comedy, which is where we are now, that act four, is so degraded. Everyone's a prostitute. Everybody's selling themselves.
And everyone's syphilitic.
Yeah. And it just, and you just get, we can't stay here. We have to move forward. That's such an incredible moment for me and Shakespeare's watching him determined to turn the corner from King Lear and from Timon. And then eventually get to this Tempest, which is an apology. Like step one, say that you're sorry. And step two, listen to the young people and let the young people lead because they know where they're going and they haven't yet betrayed their ideals. And that arc is pretty overwhelming. And again, the Tempest is also about the creatures and recognizing that, you know, it's a total ecology. Anyway, just to say, for me, please, if you can, find Ayana's work. The new book is about teaching Shakespeare. And I think it's probably one of the most thrilling books written because it's about an empowerment of not the teacher telling the class what Shakespeare means, but exactly reversing the process. Please go.
It's called Teaching Shakespeare with Purpose, a student-centered approach, and it really is about allowing encouraging students to embrace complexity and not teaching in the authoritarian model that Peter described from the old British, and here's the meaning that I am passing on to you. So that's what it's about. And it's co-authored with an education specialist, and it was an immense joy to write. We wrote every word together, and I'm glad you like it.
Would you just talk about the process in it, just a little bit?
The models that we talk about encouraging teachers to allow their classes to talk about the complexity of identity in their classrooms, and and having Shakespeare be one of the tools that you can use to do that. So a lot of classes that we've observed will have some sort of performance-y aspect, and it's almost always colorblind casting in the classrooms and no discussion about race or gender or whatever, which is fine. But we were thinking, well, if these are really, if you really want these to be complex texts that are relevant, why not allow the students to say who can play what and why? Why not allow them to create their own casting models and to debate them collectively? But really, it's about a more active approach to Shakespeare and having meaning come through the students as opposed to top down.
The first, when I did Merchant of Venice, of course, there were two white actors, because there was the judge, but also the white trash characters of the Gobbo family, which were Del Close was the senior guy, and the young guy was this kid named Philip Seymour Hoffman. And they were serious white trash. But otherwise, everyone else in the room was someone of color. And of course, none of these actors had ever, I mean, this was 20 years ago, things have changed since then, but none of them had ever played a major role in Shakespeare. They'd only played the walk-on in a production that didn't know the walk-on was magical.
But sadly, it hasn't changed, Peter. Well, that's okay, the sad part. I mean, in your productions, yes, this is, but like that, you know, the data doesn't bear it out. I'm sorry, I just had to interject there because it's not as hopeful as you want it to be.
So I had a room full of people who had only been cast as criminals and prostitutes and drug dealers and drug addicts and whatever in every TV show. And suddenly they were playing major roles in Shakespeare. And so there had to be some kind of process. You couldn't just say, okay, we'll start on Tuesday, go. It really needed a process. And probably one of the greatest periods of my life was we had 2 weeks together as a pre-rehearsal period before we started rehearsing the play. And we did two things. There were 17 people in the room, I think, seven. It was a big cast. But from Brazil, from Panama, from L.A., from New York, from Morocco, from all these different places, we went around, we sat around a table, and we read every line. At the end of every line, we stopped, and all 17 people said, described an experience that that line reminded them of in their life. And we created this living library of experience that every one of these lines triggered in all these different human beings. And you realize somebody else heard this line so differently from you. And this line meant all these other things that you could never have imagined. And by the time we did that for every line in The Merchant of Venice, there was this staggering library of human experience that we had, out of which we could build a production, but also with everyone understanding that no one was hearing the same thing. That we all come to this from such different understandings and such different life histories and such different set of aspirations or disappointments or sense of joy or sense of resignation. And for one person, a line is very positive, and for another person, the line is totally depressing. For one person, it reminds them of someone they love, and for another person, it reminds them of someone they can't stand. All of these experiences are in every room that all of us are in every day. Shakespeare, of course, is triggering them, is letting them come back and live. And then we did the same process the next week with the Bible, the Dhammapada, the Tao Te Ching, the Quran. And we just took a bunch of sacred texts that had to do with things that where people believe or people place their ethical and spiritual awareness. And we said, what here in these texts do we share or not share? What do we understand together or what do we not understand together? And then we built the production out of those 2 weeks. But of these human beings sharing things that were deep and important to them and that were the compass points of their lives. And for me, that is the process that America needs to go through right now, is not demonizing each other and literally understanding that we're hearing and seeing very different things over and over again. And we have to really figure out the shape of a table that lets us be together to hear each other and recognize and acknowledge how divergent our experiences are and begin to ask what kind of collective understanding or at least acknowledgement can we reach, and in the process start trying to weave and reweave an actual social fabric.
Brilliant.
So, anyway, let's open this up. Let's please open this up. We should have given you some warning that we're going to open it up. Oh my God, first question is already there, really? Okay.
Well, I'm delighted to have a... Is this on?
It is on. It could be lifted a little more, yes.
Thank you. I'm delighted to have a chance to hear about Ayana's work, and I know where to find it. And I'm wondering with you, Peter, if you have a place where you write the kinds of thoughts we've been hearing tonight that are commentary and not read between the lines, try to guess the person behind the presentation, but where you are yourself an author of articles or books or what have you.
He's actually written quite a bit. I know this because I'm writing a book on Peter right now and and have been finding all the, you know, you are very good at writing forwards to books. Did you know this? And they're really stunningly brilliant, too.
You know, I have failed to write my famous book at least 7 times by now. I've gone through 7 contracts of different publishers. The book never arrives. One book did arrive. The fantastic Maria Delgado in London decided to edit a lot of my public talks into something that became a book, and I looked at it and would not let them publish it. I just said, oh, my God, what I thought in 1987, who cares? And I was very annoyed reading it. And I said, no, I should sit and really write. Well, that hasn't happened. So it's very irritating. So I apologize. I was supposed to write a book in the couple of weeks before Christmas. And that didn't happen either. I'm close, because there are things on my mind. What I really want to write is a very, very short, light paperback that a young artist can go on a trip to Asia with and have it in their rucksack, and that is just inspiring. And that is not a definitive treatise on anything, but it's just about how to make art in a way that is immediate and necessary, and I'd like to do that, but just in a way that gives permission to younger generation of people. So that's really what I'm hoping to do. That will come soon. Yes. Oh my God, you're running everywhere.
Thank you. Hello, hello.
Hello.
Thank you both so much for coming, for your wonderful work in this extraordinary evening. Mr. Sellers, I would love to hear one or two of your Uncle Floyd's Shakespearean commentaries on his life and what brought just those particular situations that brought Shakespeare to his mind. He must have been a marvelous man.
Say that one more. I want to make sure I'm understanding.
So I think she wants to know what were the contexts in which Uncle Floyd would burst out with Shakespeare.
Oh, my God, Uncle Floyd, yes. Okay. well, basically in very difficult family situations where somebody needed to be wise, Uncle Floyd in his funky way could be wise. And you, he's the last person you ever would think of being wise. And he had this just beautiful, strange, dithering humanity that in the end of the day, you know, always say, it's always hard to believe that all people are needed. You say, I know these people are needed, but why did these people have to be here? And of course, the fact is all people are needed and are crucial and are irreplaceable. And we, in our strange mechanistic world, don't get that. And Uncle Floyd, in this beautiful way, was somebody who was like orbiting from some other solar system. And then suddenly, thank God, he existed and was there and could say the beautiful thing that no one else could say and created harmony in his beautiful, funky, zoned out way. And that magnificence of the unnecessary person. You know, and it's now so sad. We only, you know, the only people who are allowed to live are people who are earning money, and we only want to bring people to this country who are like absolutely qualified professionals. And it's just such a pathetic notion of human value. And what makes every human being valuable is not that they're a world-class surgeon. It's that they're a person. And their value is incalculable. And Uncle Floyd was one of those marvelous, incalculable beings. And illuminated the world in total, weird, unexpected moments. And then fell asleep on the bus. And you just have to be grateful. So good.
Next question? Yes. Hi. I'm wondering if you could comment on an argument that I've been hearing a lot lately about how we should be either encouraging or accepting of more translations of Shakespeare, not into like slang or anything like that, but just into language that takes some of the more archaic vocabulary and updates it to more modern words without supposedly reducing complexity.
Do you want to start or should I start?
Well, you should start.
But you have to pick up on this, right?
Yes, I do.
I'll just say really fast, my own favorite Shakespeare is Shakespeare in other languages. And my favorite Shakespeare productions, I mean, I've rarely ever seen a Shakespeare production in English I can sit through. And meanwhile, Shakespeare in Russian, Shakespeare in Bulgarian, Shakespeare in Bangladeshi, Shakespeare in all these other languages is so powerful because people are coming to the piece not as a question of language, but as a question of substance. And so when you see King Lear, you know, heroically done in the film by Kosinsev in Russia in the 60s with that incredible score by Shostakovich with incredible translation by Pasternak and with Yuri, you know, the great Estonian actor playing Lear, and the set looks like the Kremlin from the 12th century. And, you know, it's 1/10 of Shakespeare's King Lear, but it's felt so deeply and done so courageously that Shakespeare is totally there. And so for me, it's not about, you know, quantity. It's just about the spirit, the feeling, the meaning, the humanity, the depth of imagination, the depth of aspiration. Shakespeare wrote plays because he was concerned about the future of England and the future of the planet. And he wrote about civil war because that is the daily reality. Something we know really well in America is every day it's civil war continues. And so most of Shakespeare's plays are about civil war and the consequences, and the civil war that's coming, or the civil war we're recovering from, or the civil war we're in the middle of. And how can we treat each other with some nobility in an ignoble period. And when you see people in Bulgaria or Korea reach to that image because they need that image, it's so powerful. And it's not about language. The other side, I would just simply say, as we were saying a minute ago before we came out here, the reason Shakespeare is so powerful in prison programs is here are people whose lives are so complex, and there are not words to describe the appalling, appalling things that are that happened to them and that are now happening to them. As you know, prison is about stamping out people's last trace of humanity, and the only successful prisoner is the person who accepts complete injustice on a daily basis, silently. Shakespeare offers words to people who are not allowed to speak, and those words are powerful. And Shakespeare's words in the mouths of people who have not been permitted to express themselves are irreplaceable.
I guess the only thing I would add...
No, please. No, this is her deal.
The only thing I would add is that it's not an either or. So I'm involved in the Oregon Shakespeare Festival's translation project. I'm a dramaturg for the translation of Othello. And I think a lot of my colleagues, Shakespeare colleagues, have come out condemning the project, saying this is the death of Shakespeare, as if we're, you know, getting a bonfire together and lighting all the ardent texts in the middle and saying it's only translations from now on. Like it's a false dichotomy. It's a false binary. As you know, Peter just brilliantly said that there's always been translations of Shakespeare. They are often better than anything you could see in, you know, than done in Shakespeare's language. But they haven't replaced Shakespeare's language either. So they will both exist, coexist happily. And I think that's a great place to be. And sometimes Shakespeare's original words are exactly the things that are needed, just as they were needed on Robben Island during apartheid in South Africa. Nelson Mandela famously, looked to Shakespeare. Those are moments where the original language can be incredibly powerful, but that doesn't also mean that a translation in Japanese or in Russian, the best Twelfth Night I ever saw was a Russian, unreal Russian production. It was so good. So they can coexist. I think we have to get my colleagues out of the business of thinking it's either or. That's a false game. It's just like, you know, kind of contemporary politics. You have to decide. And you're like, actually, I don't have to decide between these things.
And a bunch of your YouTube rap versions that you write about are so breathtaking. And, you know, where kids have just gotten into Macbeth, and I mean into it, like way into it.
Yeah, and not with all just, the complexity.
And not on the surface, And that means that they broke through the language and went to... You know, because again, the language is it's like the envelope, but the content is what the envelope is delivering. Yeah. And so please open the envelope. Yeah. Oh, no, not the last!
Sorry, that's so much pressure.
All these people up front were neglected.
Now I feel terrible. I hope it's a good question. Which of Shakespeare's plays really would frighten you or disturb you to produce, to put up, to mount? Sort of which ones are the scariest, the most intimidating, and in what way?
I hate Othello. I hate it. I mean, I just did the Arden Othello. I wrote the new introduction. I hate that play. I hate it. I hate seeing it. I hate seeing it with white audiences. I hate it. I think it's the most terrifying play for me personally, but also I know that I can say this on behalf of many Black Americans. It's an awful theatrical experience. When it's a good production, it sucks, and when it's a bad production, it sucks.
And she helped with my production of it.
Which was brilliant.
It was a brilliant production. I think you did it as well. I think your production did it as well as it can be done, because you were precisely right to say and to force people, and the critics couldn't handle it at all. To force people to think about the power of racism in a multicultural world. Like, it doesn't just go away when you have a multicultural world. It's still there. That narrative is still there. And the production was so good at making audiences look at
Othello was not the only person of color on stage. By a long shot, because by then Obama was president. So I said, okay, the Duke of Venice also has to be black. And Cassio also has to be black. And
Amelia.
And a whole bunch of other people. So it wasn't just that there was one black guy surrounded by everyone. It really had this different dynamic. But it was also a shock because I'm the person who really hated that play. I didn't want to do it. Toni Morrison said to me, "You're wrong." Okay, if Toni says it, I probably have to listen. And she said, no. Iago, those speeches, perfect Dick Cheney. And she said, the tragedy isn't that they kill what you love. It's that they convince you to kill what you love. Yes. And that's why this play is to the point right now. You're the person that ceases to believe in the very thing that your life is based on. And you'll jump ship to join up with something that's worthless. And that was never true. So Toni made me do it. And then once I started, Obama started running for president. And while we rehearsed, the election was going on. And when the show opened, Obama was president.
And Sonia Sotomayor was being...
Was
being confirmed.
And so the shock for me was this play... 400 years old, that I said, it's really irrelevant. It's just embarrassing. Shakespeare had no black friends, and it really shows. And you can't blame him, but he just wasn't hanging out in the right places. And I said, this embarrassing play, which clearly is not helpful to the world, why are we still doing it? And then, in the third week of Obama's term, the first Obama-Hitler posters started appearing. And this weird thing that suddenly even his friends were saying, well, he's not really, we're actually trying to undermine his presidency. And you watch this weird miasma develop where suddenly Obama couldn't do anything. That, you know, the most powerful black man on the face of the earth suddenly can't do anything. And suddenly this play from 400 years ago was absolutely spot on accurate. As you watch this brilliant guy be immobilized by everyone. It was shocking. And so I suddenly had a lot of respect.
No, I get all that. I just think it's painful.
It's painful. They call it tragedy. Yeah. No, it's super painful. I couldn't agree more. Okay, so just to be even, the play I can never do is Titus Andronicus.
No, Peter, you have to do it.
Too horrible.
No, all right. I'm no Toni Morrison, but I'm on the case.
May we thank Louise.
Louise, woo.
And
thank
just
you, Peter.
Whatever's coming up next in our country, Shakespeare's been there. And literally, those plays are absolutely roadmaps for what we're in the middle of. And we will be in the middle of it, and we will come out the other side. Thank you.
Thank you.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, Sharon Oxborough, the Estate of Suzanne Aaron, Donna and Martin J. Wolfe, Julia Meltzer, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM. Music by Boya Pongo. Support these free programs by becoming a member of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Visit lfla.org for more information.